I need to give a brief introduction to the way that our legal system works in order for us to understand how this whole thing started and how we can fight it. Okay, our system of government is governed by the Constitution. It's a document written only 4,400 words. It was written in 1787, and that governs our entire system of government. The Constitution creates three branches of government: the legislative, which creates the laws; the executive, which enforces the laws; and the judicial, which interprets the laws. Now, one thing that's important about our branches of government under the Constitution is that the president, the executive, is elected to four-year terms, and the legislature, the Congress, representatives are elected to two-year terms, and in the Senate, senators are elected to six-year terms. Does this sound okay? Okay. Okay. But the judiciary, one very important thing is that the judges, they're not elected. They're appointed by the president with the advice and the consent of the Senate. That means they're appointed for life. Once they're in, they're in. They're not politically accountable. You can't take them out of office because you don't like what they're doing. The Supreme Court consists of nine justices. Each member votes on the outcome of a case. Now, you need a majority to win, so you need five votes to prevail. 5-4 gets the result done just as well as 6-3 will. Now, every branch is bound by the Constitution. For instance, the president, he can grant pardons and reprieves, but he can't do so in cases of impeachment. So let's say that the vice president's impeached. The president can't pardon him. The legislature is also bound by the Constitution. It can't enact any law that violates the Constitution. For instance, the First Amendment. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Congress can't create the National Baptist Church, the National Reformed Baptist Church. It can't do that. That would violate the Constitution. But the ultimate question is, who interprets the Constitution to determine whether it's been violated? The courts, the Supreme Court. Okay, so let me just give a quick hypothetical. Let's say that Congress passes a law that grants tax-exempt status to a religious charity. Let's say the Supreme Court declares the law unconstitutional. It says that it violates the Establishment Clause. Remember, I read to you the First Amendment. Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion. Let's say Congress says, okay, that's unconstitutional. And by the way, just to be clear, that's not unconstitutional. The Supreme Court has already held that it isn't, but this is just a hypothetical. Well, let's say the court changed its mind and said that's unconstitutional. What can Congress do? It can't just say we disagree with your interpretation. It can't just pass a law that overturns the Supreme Court. It can't really do anything. What can we as citizens do? Well, we can't elect new Supreme Court justices. They're not elected. They're appointed for life. So we only have two options. First, we could amend the Constitution. But the problem with that is that an amendment must be approved by 2/3 of the Congress and ratified by 3/4 of the state. That's extremely difficult, if not impossible, for controversial issues. It's not going to happen. Or we could elect a president who will appoint justices who have a different interpretation of the Constitution. And really, that's our only approach. And it still has problems. One, we have to wait for a vacancy. Justices sometimes serve 30-plus years before retiring or dying. Justices will even serve until they're senile to avoid stepping off when a president of the opposite political party is in power. Currently, Justice Stevens is 87 years old. Fortunately, he's not senile, but I don't know how much longer he's going to keep going. He's hoping for a Republican president or a Democratic president because he can't make it another 4 years. But the problem is, what if a president appoints a justice thinking that he or she will interpret the Constitution in a particular way, and this justice doesn't once elected? That happens all the time. Okay, let's look at abortion now. We have to look at the road to abortion. Those who were pushing for abortion had a very long-term goal. They were patient. They had a strategy. The biggest mover in this movement was Planned Parenthood. Planned Parenthood was founded in 1942 by Margaret Sanger. And Margaret Sanger, she was dedicated pretty much to liberalizing laws on contraception. The long-term goal was that she opened the door to contraception and eventually liberalize abortion. She coined the term birth control, which is a deliberately vague term. Does everybody know the difference between contraception and birth control? Contraception refers to conception, when the egg and the sperm get together. Contraception simply means contraconception. We prevent them from uniting. Birth control, that's a little more ambiguous. Think about it. What does that mean? You prevent a birth from happening. That may be through preventing conception, or it may be through preventing the birth from happening. It's deliberately vague. Now, what was the policy behind birth control? It's not a very pleasant one. Margaret Sanger had a contempt for minorities and the poor. And she strategically placed birth control clinics in black and poor communities. She was part of the eugenics movement of the early 20th century. And the slogan that she coined, more of the fit, less of the unfit. So from the beginning, this was not a very noble cause. Well, in 1965, Planned Parenthood was able to get a case before the court in Griswold in Connecticut. It involved a Connecticut law that prohibited the use or advocacy of contraception to prevent pregnancy. Now, this probably doesn't display well, but I put in parentheses blue law. And what a blue law means is that it's on the books, but it's not been enforced for years. It's an old law, like back to the almost colonial times. Of course, not really, but pretty old. So it was kind of a bluff. Now, who's Griswold? Well, Griswold was Estelle Griswold, and she was the executive director of Planned Parenthood League of Connecticut. So again, we see Planned Parenthood is on the move. And the Supreme Court held that the prohibition against contraception was an unconstitutional violation of the right to privacy. Okay, so who knows in the Constitution where the right to privacy is located? Yes? Okay. You said search and seizure. That's the Fourth Amendment. It says that persons shall be free of unreasonable search and seizure. That certainly is a type of privacy, right? Okay, what about quartering your troops? No, the Third Amendment. No, you don't have to quarter your troops in time of war. That's a type of privacy, too. But where is there a generalized right of privacy in the Constitution? It doesn't exist. So one of the ways in which they found this general right of privacy is through the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment. And what the Due Process Clause says, this was right after the Civil War they passed this, they wanted to protect the newly freed slaves. And so the 14th Amendment stated, no state shall deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. And now the operative term here is liberty. So this is kind of how the court thought, and see if you can find a flaw in this reasoning. Well, surely we all have the liberty to choose whether we want to have children or not, right? I mean, can the law say, Kayum, you will bear 3 children from the state, you shall name them Michael, Joe, and Pete? Can the state really do that? Well, no, because it seems like a natural right. It's inherent. Okay, it's not written in the Constitution, but all right, we kind of buy that. And so what they said was, well, by prohibiting contraception, you're forcing people to have children. Well, not really, but that's how the court kind of ruled. Yeah, Tony. Okay. At that screen. Oh, okay. Cool. Nope. Okay. Now, that foundation was laid. That was a pivotal case, Griswold. That set the stage for Roe v. Wade, and we all know about this case, 1973. It was the landmark case. It involved a Texas law that criminally prohibited abortion unless necessary to save the life of the mother. Now, how did they get into court? Well, this wasn't a case of normal people saying, hey, my rights have been infringed, I want to sue the government. This was a bunch of feminist lawyers who were looking for plaintiffs to challenge the law. They were looking for pregnant women who would volunteer to be plaintiffs so they could say, you know what, I'm pregnant, I want an abortion, the state's preventing me from having one, so I'm going to sue. And they found one, Norma McCorvey. And Norma McCorvey's infamous name became Jane Roe to protect her identity. And she claimed that she was pregnant by rape. One thing we have to say is that there's a lot of lying in how we got abortion. We couldn't have gotten there without lying a great bit. And this is one of the common lies of the pro-abortion proponents. They love to capitalize on rape and incest, even though they comprise only about 1-2% of pregnancies, unwanted pregnancies, if that. And why do they do it? Well, they want to evoke sympathy for the woman. It's not her fault. She was raped. You cruel, unjust government. This poor woman. Well, Norma McCorvey later admitted that she lied about being raped. And she eventually became a Christian, actually. Jane Roe became a Christian. That's amazing. If you don't want to get into the technical parts of the law on abortion, you might want to read this, though. This is her book, Won by Love, where she tells her story of how she became a Christian. It's really a great tale. So what was their argument, Roe v. Wade? Well, they basically came up with this argument, and again, let's think about the reality of this. They said, basically, illegal abortions were happening all over the country. 10,000 women per year were dying of back alley abortions because they were unsafe, they were illegal, they were shady, you know, they were in these holes in the wall. And they even propounded this myth that women would even go to the extremes of using wire coat hangers to self-induce an abortion. I'm sorry to gross you out, but that was the constant theme, coat hangers back then. That's what they said. And there's really only one problem with those abortion statistics, is that they're completely false. Because abortion was illegal, we can't be actually 100% certain of the exact number of women who died from illegal abortions each year. But the Center for Disease Control, let's see, do I have that? Yeah, the Center for Disease Control, you can't see that right there, estimated a number, 39 deaths. Not 10,000, 39. Now, that's probably a little low, like I said, because there's an incentive to underreport these things. But if it's in the hundreds, I'd be surprised. Certainly not 10,000. Now, Dr. Bernard Nathanson, at the time, he was called the abortion king of New York. He performed more abortions than anybody else. And he later became pro-life. And he later became a Christian, too. He founded a group called NARAL, National Association for the Repeal of Abortion Laws. So he was the abortion proponent par excellence. He was the biggest mover and shaker, one of the biggest, in legalizing abortion. And here's what he said later. I confess that I knew the figures were totally false. And I suppose the others did too, if they stopped to think about it. But in the morality of our revolution, it was a useful figure, widely accepted. So why go out of our way to correct it with honest statistics? The overriding concern was to get the laws eliminated, and anything within reason that had to be done was permissible. These people were on a moral crusade. They believed strongly in what they were doing, and they would lie. They would employ any techniques they needed to get the law against abortion eliminated. Again, that's a common theme. So, Roe v. Wade, the court held that the Texas law, abortion law, was unconstitutional. And it built off of Griswold. It said, well, just as contraception forces people to have children, well, if a woman's pregnant and she can't have an abortion, you're forcing her to have children. Can anybody see the logical fallacy in that argument? It's not forcing her to bear children, to beget children. It's saying once you've become pregnant and have children, you can't eliminate them. It's squishy reasoning, but the court's not averse to squishy reasoning when it likes a particular result. And what it did was it came up with this trimester scheme. It said, during the first trimester, you can't regulate abortion at all. None. Not for any reason. During the second trimester, you can regulate abortion, but only to protect the life or health of the mother. You cannot regulate it to protect the life of the unborn. During the third trimester, you can regulate to protect potential life, even to the point of prohibiting it altogether. Now, I said you can regulate to protect the fetus during the third trimester. You don't have to. And that means that if the state wanted to allow abortions up to the day of birth, they can. Tony?
I'm just curious what you just went over.
Okay.
You said the
judicial
branch, their job is to interpret the law.
Yeah.
The legislative branch's job is to create the law.
Yeah. Yeah, the job of the judiciary is to interpret the law. The job of the legislature is to make the law. And this was like during the heyday of what's called judicial activism. The court was just striking down laws left and right, saying, you must do this, you must do this. It was drunk on its own power. And if you even look at that trimester scheme, where is that in the Constitution? I mean, that's like a law in its detail and its provisions. You're absolutely right. Okay. So you can regulate it in the third trimester, but you don't have to. Well, there's a problem. There are also two exceptions to the third trimester. Now, I'm sorry if we can't see that. You cannot prohibit abortion during the third trimester if it's necessary to protect either the life or the health of the mother. Life is pretty easy to understand, but what about health? That kind of seems reasonable. I mean, I guess we evoke this image of this woman being crippled for the rest of her life because she's going to have a child. Now, I still think that's a child deserving of protection, but it evokes some sympathy. But what most people don't know is that on the exact same day that Roe v. Wade was handed down, another case called Doe v. Bolton was handed down. And Doe defined health very broadly. The factors include, this is a quote, physical, emotional, psychological, familial, and the woman's age, even the stigma of unwed motherhood. That's health. So what does that mean? It means that a woman can terminate her pregnancy in any state in the nation up to birth. Okay? All she has to do is concoct a mental health reason. I can't bear it. I'm not ready. I will say that there's one limitation. Many states, the problem is if you want to abort one day before your birth, you've got to find a physician. And thank God, many physicians will refuse personally to go past, say, 24 weeks. But there are some. There are some. There's one in Kansas being prosecuted right now. And we'll see in a little bit those who don't like to abide by those restrictions. Okay, the trimester scheme. Why can the state protect unborn life in the third trimester but not in the second? Well, Lydia is probably the expert on this. At the time, what divided the second trimester and the third trimester is viability. And what viability means is that the fetus is able to survive outside the mother. But there's a problem with viability. And obviously the first problem is, so wait, the fetus isn't a person, isn't a life, just because it can't survive outside the mother? What about those who depend on others for their, you know, help or oxygen or food? But setting that aside, another problem is that the viability line keeps moving back with increased medical technology. In 1907, we don't know exactly what viability was, but certainly it was after 30 weeks. In Roe, 1973, it was 28 weeks. Today, it's 22 weeks. And we all remember Joel Tadd. Joel Tadd was born at 24 weeks, and he survived. Well, he wasn't viable at the time of Roe, and so he wasn't a person. He wasn't alive. Tomorrow, who knows what viability will be? What if we can protect life from conception? I don't know. Actually, I do know. I have a theory as to what will be the case, and we'll talk about that in a second. Okay, what if Roe were overturned? We all want Roe to be overturned. But here's what would happen if Roe were overturned. The issue would go back to the states. That means that each state could choose to prohibit or allow abortion. Some states have what are called trigger laws. That means that they have a law in the books that says the moment, the second that Roe v. Wade is overturned, abortion is outlawed in this state. Now that, I have a lot to say about that. I think that's very important. So let's say Roe is overturned. What if Tennessee outlaws Virginia, but Virginia allows, or sorry, Tennessee outlaws abortion? Tennessee, I'm sure some Tennessee would like to outlaw Virginia, but I'm moving there, so I don't want them to. Okay, so if Tennessee outlaws abortion, but Virginia allows, what's going to happen? Well, women are going to travel to Virginia to get an abortion. Make no mistake about it. So what's the point? What's the point? If half the country is going to be going to have liberalized abortion laws, what's the point? Is it going to be the same thing? Well, there is a point. First of all, some women wouldn't. Obstacles do prevent people from prevent women from getting abortion. Why do you think that it's important? You know, Planned Parenthood is intent on having so many abortion centers. Convenience. You're not going to strike at sin unless it's convenient enough. If it's too inconvenient, you're not going to do it. But here's the real reason why it's important. And I'm going to hammer this. orthodoxy. It's a powerful message that abortion is wrong. Now, the law doesn't just regulate behavior. The law is a tutor. And that's one thing that I've learned more and more about the law. The law teaches right and wrong. It creates moral leanings in us. In Romans 7:7, Paul even says, I would not have known sin except through the law. For I would not have known covetousness unless the law had said, thou shalt not covet. Orthodoxy. After Roe, we get to the dark period. From 1973 to 1989, the Supreme Court struck down every state attempt to restrict abortion. You couldn't win. Here are some of the examples of the things that the Supreme Court struck down. Spousal consent requirement. No. Even though it's the man's child as well, he cannot have a veto over the decision to abort. Parental consent requirement for minors. They struck that down, but they did allow one exception if it contained a sufficient judicial bypass procedure. And what that basically means is that the minor girl, the minor pregnant girl, goes to a court and says, you know, I don't want to tell my parents. Will you guys issue me an order that I can get an abortion? And, I mean, that's pretty much a rubber stamp. No court is going to say no. The requirement that abortions after the first trimester be performed in a hospital, that was struck down. Now, this is what's really interesting. Remember one of the typical arguments for legalizing abortion was that we want to make it safe. We're going to legalize it because we're going to make it safe and so women won't keep dying from these illegal abortions. Well, what's interesting is that every single medical proposal that is proposed to raise the standards, health standards of abortion, groups like the ACLU and Planned Parenthood will fight tooth and nail. I've heard this. I don't know if it's true, so don't take my word for it, but I've heard that abortion clinics have lower medical standards than veterinary clinics. And this is what the lie was. We protect abortion, so we make it safe. Okay. And another thing that was struck down was informed consent requirements. Basically, you go in and you go into a doctor and you're going to have your appendix removed. That doctor is going to sit you down whether you want it or not, and it's going to go over, okay, well, this is going to happen, and then I'm going to do this. Now, you're going to feel a little bit like this, and you might have this pain afterward, and you have to know that there's a risk of death in every major surgery, and all, I mean, that's what the doctor, am I right, John? Okay. Well, there was an effort to have the same thing. We wanted there were laws passed that the abortionist had to communicate to the woman the development of the fetus, how old the fetus is, the date of viability, complications that might result from an abortion. And the Supreme Court said, no, you can't require abortionists to communicate this information to pregnant women. Why? Well, they said, well, the information isn't meant to inform the woman, but to persuade her. So you can't communicate this information if it might persuade the woman not to have an abortion. Well, let me be clear. It's not that the abortionist can't communicate it, but the state can't require the abortionist to communicate it. There's also a 24-hour waiting period requirement. That was struck down. If you want to go into an abortion clinic and get an abortion right now, the state can't even make you think it over for 24 hours. But there was one ray of light. The Supreme Court did hold 5-4, a single vote made a difference, that both states and the federal government could subsidize childbirth and refuse to subsidize abortion. This is a big thing. And not all states have followed suit. Several states have required that if you're going to subsidize childbirth, you have to subsidize abortion. In Massachusetts, you can't not subsidize abortion. You're required by the state constitution to subsidize abortion. That's a scary thing. And we're fortunate that that's not the case nationally. This brings us to Planned Parenthood. How am I doing on time? Okay. This brings us to Planned Parenthood versus Casey. And this involved a number of restrictions in Pennsylvania. There was a 24-hour waiting period and informed consent requirements. There was a spousal consent requirement. There was a parental consent requirement, and there were detailed reporting requirements for abortion clinics. Those were the specific issues. But the broader issue was that the court was asked to overturn Roe v. Wade in 1992. We had put several justices in the Supreme Court. Presidents Reagan and Bush had just put, I think it was five. Reagan and Bush had put, I think four or five different justices in the Supreme Court. We were convinced that we finally had enough votes to overturn Roe v. Wade. And the court decides 5-4, to everybody's surprise, one vote, to reaffirm Roe v. Wade. And what's the reason the court gave? The court said basically, well, even if abortion is wrong, we can't mandate our own moral code. We can't impose our view on the nation. Really? I thought that's what law did. And it said that each person, quote, has the right, listen to this language, this is incredible. Each person has the right to define one's own concept of existence, of meaning, of the universe, and of the mystery of life. What does that mean? I mean, it's great poetry, but I mean, we're talking about law here. Postmodern, yeah, it really is. Okay, question, where does this chain of reasoning end? Is murder a moral issue? Does murder involve the definition and the mystery of life? I have a different moral take on murder. Why is the state able to impose its moral viewpoint on me? Racial discrimination. Why is the state able to tell me, now I'm not I don't want to discriminate racially, just to be clear. Why can the state tell me that I can't discriminate racially if I don't want to sell my house to a minority? That's a moral issue, but the state is imposing its moral viewpoint on me. Why is this different? But one thing that Casey did do, and this is very important, is that Casey did enact a compromise. While it refused to overturn Roe, it agreed to taper it back a little bit. It tossed out the trimester scheme, and now it's just viability, pre-viability, post-viability. If viability gets pushed back, then abortion restrictions get pushed back. And the new standard is that an abortion restriction is okay. All abortion restrictions are fair game unless they produce what's called an undue burden on pre-viability abortions. What does that mean? I don't know. But it's a lighter standard than before. And we know that because the Supreme Court upheld the 24-hour waiting period. It upheld the informed consent requirements. It upheld the parental consent requirements with the bypass procedure. It upheld the detailed reporting requirements. It denied the spousal consent requirements. But these would have never survived under Roe. Never. Casey tapered Roe back. And consistent with the undue burden standard, the court said that a state can now take a position on abortion. Remember I said before that the Supreme Court said, no, you can't tell this woman all this information because it might persuade her. Well, the Supreme Court said, okay, we're going to taper it back. Now the state can take a position on the issue. It may, quote, express a preference for childbirth over abortion. It may attempt to persuade the woman to choose childbirth over adoption. It may enact laws that function solely to express profound respect for the life of the unborn. So what does it mean for a law to function solely to express profound respect for the life of the unborn? Here's an example. Death certificates for aborted babies. Think about it. It would save no lives, and it would place no restrictions. But what would it do? It would communicate a message that these fetuses were living human beings. Okay? That's what we're talking about expressing profound respect. Now, I mean, obviously the cynical response, and it's the correct response, is, well, how much respect for life can you really have when the state can't protect lives from murder? It's a good question, but Casey is important, and we'll see why it is. Okay, and this is where it gets important. All right, I've racked my brain trying to figure out how to present these cases in the most sanitary way possible, and I've reworked it over and over again, and I just have to ask you to bear with me. I'm not being gross for the sake of being gross. I'm not trying to use shock tactics, but I can't explain my point unless I explain these procedures. So if you're not comfortable with that or your children are comfortable with that, okay. Partial birth abortion. It's a procedure for second trimester abortions. The normal procedure for second trimester abortions is something called dilation and evacuation. What happens is that the abortionist inserts forceps into the woman and basically dismembers the baby piece by piece. The alternative method is something called dilation and extraction, or DNX, aka partial birth abortion. It's an easier way to do it, and what they do is they deliver the baby partially, and they have to do it breech, usually. They deliver it all except for the head. Once they get to that point, they suck the brains of the baby out, which causes the skull to collapse and the baby to be delivered. The fetus is then killed. This is remarkably similar to infanticide. It's a gruesome procedure. I don't know how to present it any better. I'm sorry. People were pretty outraged about this new procedure. And Nebraska outlawed the procedure altogether. And they said, we're going to outlaw the procedure. And it didn't even provide a health exception for the mother. Well, in Stenberg versus Carhart in 2000, the Supreme Court struck it down. The Supreme Court said, no, you can't prohibit this procedure. And the reason why you can't prohibit this procedure is because there's a lack of a health exception. and the lack of a health exception creates an undue burden on women seeking an abortion. Well, Congress reacted too. And Congress, like Nebraska, outlawed the procedure. And like Nebraska, it produced no health exception. And the reason why it had no health exception, well, we know why it had no health exception, because we know that how squishy this health exception is. And it also made detailed findings that a partial birth abortion is never medically necessary. One thing, I don't know if this is true or not, I heard this. I've heard that when they were debating this in Congress, several legislators were forced, as much as they can be forced, to watch the procedure. Anybody ever heard of, again, this is something I've heard, I haven't verified this, that Eisenhower, after World War II, he took all the Germans around the concentration camps and he made them walk through the concentration camps to see what they had willfully turned their eyes to. Kind of the same thing. In 2000, just this summer, the Supreme Court, praise God, upheld the Federal Partial Birth Abortion Act in a 5-4 decision. One vote difference. One vote difference. And we can't ignore that in between those two decisions, there was the appointment of Justices Roberts and Alito to the bench. One vote difference. Okay. Why did they uphold it? Well, they said, we're going to take Casey seriously. Remember, Casey said that the state can enact laws that express profound respect for the life of the unborn. Respect for life? Well, here's the thing. If they ban DNX, the DNE, the dismemberment procedure, is still available. The abortionist can't do DNX. Okay, I'll just do DNE. It's not going to save any lives. So what's the point? Well, the point is respect for life. Congress determined that partial birth abortion had and this is a quote, had a disturbing similarity to infanticide. And it was concerned with drawing a bright line between the two. What's at play here? What's at play here is orthodoxy. The state is morally condemning a gruesome act. The state is saying, no, this is wrong. Okay? Even if lives aren't saved. And if this weren't a big deal, abortion proponents wouldn't be fighting it tooth and nail. But they hated this decision. But this is important. Okay. So that's the case law on abortion. Actually, there's mounds more. My outline was originally many, many pages. And then my wife looked at it and said, uh-uh. So why do we have an abortion right? Where does this right come from? Let's think philosophically a little bit. Under Casey, really there are two reasons. There's moral autonomy. The state can't tell you what position to take on abortion. Every person has to come to his or her own conclusion about that. Then there's another reason that was offered in Casey, and that's gender equality. The court said, abortion is necessary for women to participate equally in the workforce. Now, let's think about that for a second. Is that true? Is abortion necessary for women to participate equally in the workforce? I mean, a woman's going through medical school, or she's an engineer, or even a high school student, you know, and she gets pregnant. What can she do? Seems, I guess, like a good argument. But think about this. What's the alternative? One of them is adoption. Another thing, think about this. What's different now than from Roe? What do we have today? We've got government-subsidized daycare. We've got mandatory maternity leave. We've got gender and maternity discrimination laws. We've got all these laws in the books. Okay? Today's workforce is sympathetic to the woman more than at any other time in the history. Okay? Who fought for these laws? Feminists. Feminists fought for these laws. So why can't we use them now? A recent poll found that 70% of men and women don't believe it's necessary for a woman to have abortion to participate equally in the workplace. Okay, so really, why, if the woman can participate equally in the workplace without abortion, why the abortion right? I thought about this, and this is basically what I've come to the conclusion of. If the baby can survive outside the woman at viability, why don't we just restrict abortion until viability? Okay, you don't like being pregnant, we're so sorry, you just have to bear it to 24 weeks, then you can have the baby and we'll take care of it from there. I mean, doesn't that make sense? Why do we flip it? What's really at stake? Well, what happens if a woman goes that long and then she has a baby? She has a baby. What if she aborts? She never had a baby. Women don't show immediately. So what's really at stake is the constitutional right to never have been pregnant. That's what I've come to the conclusion. It's the constitutional right to undo the pregnancy, the constitutional right to be free from shame. You don't know if the woman was ever pregnant. Okay. That said, what do we do now politically? Let's get down to details here. Well, we vote for those who protect life. The president, who will appoint justices to the Supreme Court who will protect life. Senators, who will confirm the appointment of pro-life justices. The president can't appoint a justice on his own. He needs the Senate to confirm. We need representatives who will vote for laws to protect the unborn. We need state government, too. The governor in Tennessee appoints the Tennessee Supreme Court justices. And I don't know if you know this, but the Tennessee Supreme Court held in 2000 that the Tennessee Constitution protects the abortion right. Oh, I already have that on there. Okay. In Tennessee, every 8 years, okay, and I said it, in the federal arena, justices are appointed for life. They're not politically accountable. There's nothing you can do. In Tennessee, it's a little different. While the governor appoints the justices, in Tennessee, every 8 years, citizens can vote yes or no on retaining a state judge. We can toss out a state judge. Simple majority vote. We must, what did I say there? We must remove any judge who will not protect life. In 2000, the Tennessee Supreme Court held that Tennessee state constitution protects abortion. So even if Roe v. Wade were overturned, the Tennessee would say, oh, you can't prohibit it in Tennessee because our constitution protects it. Those justices must be removed. Right now, there's currently a proposed amendment to the Tennessee Constitution to overrule the Supreme Court on that. Remember, you can overrule the Supreme Court by a constitutional amendment. That may or may not come up on the ballot this upcoming election season. If it does, we need to vote for it. That way, if Roe v. Wade is ever overturned, we are able to outlaw abortion. What kind of laws can we pass after Roe? Well, while the state, actually after Casey is probably more accurate, while the state can't place an undue burden on access to abortion, it can't express laws that express respect for life. This is what I've been talking about the whole time, orthodoxy. The law says, no, this is wrong, this is life. Here's some examples. Several states have constitutional amendments saying that life begins at conception. Colorado right now is on a push, a major push, and I think it's going to make it, at least to get on the ballot, to amend their constitution to say that life begins at conception. That can't overrule Roe v. Wade, but it's a powerful message, and if Roe v. Wade ever is overturned, then the state has to protect the unborn children. Fetal homicide laws. Lots of states have these. If you kill a pregnant woman, you're going to be prosecuted for two deaths. Her and her child. I mean, what's just wacko about it is these same states, they can't prohibit abortion, so if you kill the same child via abortion, it's okay. What's the criteria here? The criteria is whether it's a wanted life or not. That's when we determine whether it's a person, whether it's a life. It's whether it's a wanted life. Trigger laws. Some states like Louisiana, like I said, have laws on the books that say the moment Roe v. Wade is overturned, abortion is outlawed. Death certificates. I think this was proposed in Tennessee. I don't think it ever went forward, and I don't really know if this is in any state currently. I've heard somewhere that some states have death certificates for babies aborted after 20 weeks. I think it's a fantastic idea. I think you have to tell a woman that, okay, well, if you're going to abort your baby, you're going to have to sign the death certificate. Of course, you know that Planned Parenthood hates this. They hate it. Informed consent. We need to communicate information to the woman about the baby. We need laws that say, that allow the woman, that require the physician. Actually, I think this is in Tennessee now too. I could be wrong. I'm not too up to date on my state laws. Some states either have or have proposed laws that will make the physician, sorry, not a physician, an abortionist, a physician heals, offer to the woman, before she gets an abortion, say, would you like to hear the heartbeat? Would you like to see the sonogram? You can't make the woman look at that. That'd be First Amendment violation. But you can offer that. That's important. I mean, what woman isn't? Some women won't. But women, many women are saying, well, I'll just take a look real quick. It's just tissue. You know, what a big. And then sees that baby. I remember when Beck and I were pregnant, and she wasn't even showing. And we went and got an ultrasound, and there's this little guy there. How old? 4 months. He had all these fingers, and he was hiccuping, and he would hiccup, and he'd float to the top of the hiccup, and then he'd go down like a feather, hiccup. And I was like, we got to do something, I was, concerned parent already, but we were just shocked at how defined he was. He had a heartbeat, he had brainwaves. What can we do apolitically? We can protest at the abortuaries. I call it that because I don't know what else to call it. I can't call it an abortion clinic, just like I can't call abortionists doctors. We need to, now, some of you may disagree about protesting, but I think it's right. And I used to do it in Bloomington, and so did Beck, and I haven't done it here, and that's a shame that I haven't done it. And yes, I feel stupid doing it. I feel like an idiot. So, too bad. This is not about our dignity. We need to speak up when the subject comes up. I got this great story of my pastor back home. I love him because he doesn't care about his dignity. And one of the members of our church back in Bloomington, where he moved from, Bloomington, Indiana, was graduating, I think, from medical school, and there was a ceremony. And each of the candidates would come up, and the speakers would say something about this person, like, oh, well, this person is completing his studies and is going to go on to his residency in, internal medicine or whatever. And this one woman came up, and the speakers were just praising her. Oh, and this woman has done this, and she has been a staunch protector of reproductive rights and has helped Planned Parenthood and all this stuff. And, you know, everybody's, you know, clapping. And my dear pastor back home, in this room of dignified people, goes, boo! I mean, everybody, hair stood up on their end. And God bless him. I mean, that is just so indignant. I wouldn't do that. I hope I would. We need people to do that. We can't just be complicit about this. We need to volunteer at the local crisis pregnancy center. I know Lydia does, and probably some others of you do. We need to contribute money if we can't volunteer. And I want to say one thing. If you've had an abortion or you've been involved in abortion, I'm not so naive to think that it hasn't happened in this congregation. 40% of women, I've heard, have had abortions. God forgives. And one of the things you can do is you can speak out if the circumstances are appropriate. Some women will protest, and they'll have signs and shirts that say, I regret my abortion. That's powerful. I've heard that 90% of women regret their abortions. 60% consider suicide. We need to speak up. I want to leave one closing thought. Today, few people deny that the fetus is a life. Back in Roe, medical technology wasn't very advanced, and they could advance arguments that it wasn't a life. Today, it's pretty undisputed. I was at a presentation, and the head of obstetrics and gynecology, or the former head of Vanderbilt, Dr. Frank Bohm, he admitted, he said, yeah, it's a life, but it's a policy choice that we make. We choose that we're going to sacrifice the fetus for the career, the education, the moral autonomy, the convenience, and the secrecy of the woman. Let's consider God's condemnation of those who sacrifice their children to Moloch. That's what we're doing. We're sacrificing them on the altar of these things. He told the truth. Yeah, you can't deny it's alive. It's got a heartbeat. It's got brainwaves. Oh, yeah. This is what God says in Jeremiah 32 to those who sacrifice their children to the god Moloch. For the children of Israel have provoked me only to anger with the work of their hands. They built the high places of Baal, which are in the valley of Hinnom, to cause their sons and their daughters to pass through the fire to Moloch, which I did not command them. Nor did it come to mind that they should do this abomination. I can't even fathom that statement. God says it was so abominable that it didn't even enter his mind. I don't know of any other language in the Bible like that. If the omniscient God is so aghast at the sacrifice of innocent children that it did not even enter his mind, shouldn't we be aghast? Shouldn't we be aghast as well? Are we? And if we are, how has that been manifest in our lives? Okay. Let's take, I don't know how much time we have, but Pastor Gamble and I can answer some questions.
Yeah. We'll just take a few minutes as we start in late. We'll just start a quarter after a few minutes to see if there are any questions.
Tony?
I'm kind of curious. You may have lost it. Would it be even worthwhile with the negative regard of the positive system to seek an amendment to the Constitution to allow
No. Tony asks, should we try to amend the Constitution to remove rogue judges? Honestly, no. It's a battle you're never going to win. And while I do think that laws that only protect that only communicate respect to life, even though they don't do anything, they do something, and that they do respect life. You need 2/3 of the Senate and 3/4 of the state to amend the Constitution, and you're not going to get it. And every time that we go up for it, we've tried many times to amend the Constitution, it's failed. And we need to focus on what works. This Planned Parenthood had a long-term goal. We need to have a long-term goal. Every time we've tried to attack it face-on, we failed. We need to have a long-term goal. We are at a war for the hearts of America, and that's what orthodoxy is about. So no, I wouldn't recommend a constitutional amendment at this point. All right. Yes? I don't think so. The question is whether it would require the mother to name the child. I doubt it. You can't force people to speak. You can't force a woman to give the child a name. That's with the First Amendment. But, I mean, imagine a woman signing that after or prior. How about prior to? That'd be even better. Okay, well, you know, you're going to be really shaken up after you have your abortion, so we're just going to have you sign the death certificate right now. I'm not sure about this. I mean, that's what we want. Randy? There.
With regard to the Supreme Court, quote, making law,
yeah.
Is there a way to try to limit that and bring it back? What's the word for going back to interpreting the Constitution literally?
Originalism or strict constructionism?
Is that the right question?
Basically, you're asking, is there a right, is there like a set way we can interpret the Constitution? Like, some people say they're originalists. That means they want the original intent of the founders. I think that's, of course, what we should do. Some call themselves strict constructionists. The problem with strict constructionists is you look at a term like, Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech. Okay, well, does that mean that the government can prohibit, or the press, does that mean the government can prohibit me from posting critical comments on my web blog? Well, no, it's more expansive than that. I mean, so the Constitution is hard. Some provisions are very explicit, you know. 18 to vote. 35, I think, for president you have to be. Or maybe 40. I'm really showing my lack of knowledge on this. Those are pretty clear, but some. No unreasonable search and seizures? What's an unreasonable search and seizure? What we're looking for, and we've always thought that if we could just find one way, this system, this method of hermeneutics to interpret the Constitution will prevent rogue judges from enforcing their own views on the nation. It doesn't exist. That doesn't mean we shouldn't try to interpret the law well and make reasoned arguments, but there's no one system that's going to protect us from the corruption of man. We used to think that monarchy was the great evil, and so we escaped from England and we said, democracy. If we just have democracy. Well, that didn't work so well in the Articles of Confederation, so we had the Constitution. Okay, we'll have the judiciary, the legislative, and the executive, and there'll be these warring factions, and they'll keep corruption down. Well, that didn't work so well. Then we needed amendments. You know, oh well, the democracy is a tyranny. The courts will protect minorities, and they did. The courts were the great heroes in the 1950s and 1960s. You know, they protected minorities, and then they thought, well, you know, they got drunk on their power and said, well, we're going to protect women too, and we're going to protect privacy. And I mean, we're not going to find a system that's going to shield us from man's corruption. Yeah. Okay. Cases are presented in the federal district courts, and the federal district courts have to hear these cases, and then they can be appealed to the appellate courts, and the appellate courts have to hear these cases. Then they can petition the Supreme Court to review it. But the Supreme Court is a court of discretionary appeal. They don't have to hear. They get to choose which cases they want to hear and which they don't. That means that if there's a particular result that they like below, they might just say, we're not going to hear it. We'll just let it stand. If there's a particular, they want to overturn it, a particular decision, but they know they don't have, okay, let me back up. In order for the Supreme Court to hear the case, four justices have to agree to hear it. But sometimes justices will wisely say, you know, we don't think we have enough votes, so we're going to not hear it. Because it's better that one circuit should be holding this than that we should lose at the Supreme Court level and lose across the nation. Roberts doesn't have a lot of authority on the court. The Chief Justice Roberts what that means is that if he's in the majority, he can choose who's going to write the opinion. And what's interesting, this actually, okay. Let's say that the court divides 5-4. Okay? 5 is a majority opinion, and 4 is a dissent. This is the law. These are the losers. Whoever, if it's either the chief justice or the most senior justice in the majority, gets to choose who writes the opinion for the majority. So let's say, and this happened in Casey, the vote was originally 5-4 to overturn Roe v. Wade. We were that close. And I don't know, I think it was O'Connor, maybe it was Justice Kennedy, was a swing vote. So you had this, you know, they were just barely on this side. And I think what she did is she switched over to the other side and said, maybe I'll vote with you guys. But she wasn't sure. And so what often they'll do is when the swing vote is in play, they'll say, you're going to write the opinion. Because they know that if they can make that person write the opinion, the person will sort of go, yeah, and sort of come to agree with it more and more. Because when you argue something, you come to believe it more and more. Any other questions? Yeah, John. I mean, you can't prosecute an abortionist. You can't do it. I mean, I don't know exactly what the law is on that. Right now, there's a bitter battle going on in Kansas right now to try and indict this late-term abortionist who will perform abortions up to the day of birth. And there's all sorts of allegations that he was in kickback schemes with the attorney general and, you know, was ignoring dates and everything, and dates of viability, and was just, I mean, absolute butcher. And, I mean, it is a political, fierce battle to even prosecute this guy. The attorney general who tried to prosecute him got kicked out of office for trying to prosecute him. Then an attorney general sympathetic to him got in office, and then he later resigned because it was found that he had a kickback scheme with this abortionist. So now this other guy who was removed as attorney general is a district attorney, and now he's trying to go back to try and get... I mean, it's crazy. You can't prosecute an abortionist. They will defend him tooth and nail. We have this documentary called... And this woman is this former abortionist who was made millions off of abortion and later converted to Christianity and repented. She said, what you need is you need a good abortion doctor, and good not in terms of their skill, but a good doctor who when, not if, but when a woman dies on the table can help you cover it up. So it's more political than it is legal about actually prosecuting abortionists. One encouraging thing is that fewer and fewer people are going into that profession, and we're actually having to import them from abroad. Many abortionists are foreigners. Yeah. Yeah, we're about the worst. We're not the worst. Russia and Japan are pretty bad. Ireland prohibits it still. Poland prohibits it still. Here's the thing. In France... You'd think France would be pretty liberal, but France has laws in the books that say a woman can only have an abortion if there's a severe burden on her. Even though, I mean, she's in charge of defining that burden, but France takes a stand. She has to go all through these requirements. She has to get approval by the physicians. She has to go through like a several-week process. I mean, we're about the worst. And one of the reasons why they're the worst is all these other countries legalize abortion legislatively. Eventually they said, okay, we're going to lift this restriction, we're going to lift this. I'm not saying that's good, but the difference is that it's a democratic process. Here, unlike really any other country, well, I'm sure there are other countries, but for the most part, it was the Supreme Court that said no. And since that, it's just been an absolute mess. Any other questions? Okay, well, yeah. Heavenly Father, we know that you hate many things, but that not all things, not all sins are equal in your eyes. But you hate the slaughter of the unborn and the innocent. You hated those who sacrificed their children to Moloch. And Lord, we have sacrificed our children to Moloch. Some of us here, while we may not have done it, we've been complicitous in this act. We haven't cared. I include myself in that. I don't care enough, Lord. And We need your mercy on our nation, Lord. Abortion is not something that we chose, but something that you gave us over to in punishment for our sins. And we pray that you would lift that curse. We pray that you would lift up your hand to protect the unborn, to protect life, to protect those created in your image. Help us to be diligent in the fight. Help us not to find our salvation, our morality in fighting it, but help us to fight it because we love you and because we love your word. And we pray your blessing on Stephen as he preaches more about that in this next hour. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.